I'm Allison Kulo.
And I'm Doug Wells. Welcome to Mound Money on KPCW.
We are surrounded by death. It is in our news, our nursery rhymes, our true crime podcasts. Yet, from a young age, we are told that death is something to be feared. How are we supposed to know what we're so afraid of when we're never given the chance to look? Fueled by a childhood fascination with death, journalist Haley Campbell searches for answers in the people who make a living by working with the dead. Along the way, she encounters mass fatality investigators, embalmers, and former executioner who's responsible for ending 62 lives. She met gravediggers who have already dug their own graves, visits a cryonics facility in Michigan, goes for late-night Chinese with a homicide detective, and questions a man whose job it is to make crime scenes disappear. Haley Campbell is joining us this morning to talk about her new book, All the Living and the Dead. This book weaves together reportage with memoir, history, and philosophy to offer readers a fascinating look into the psychology of Western death. Haley, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Let's begin with, why did you write the book and how long did it take you to write it?
I think this book has been in my head since I was a little kid. I've always been fascinated with death. And when I was a kid, I had lots of questions about it, as kids do. You know, if you hang out with a kid for any extended period of time, you end up exhausted by the amount of questions. And my questions were focused on the practicalities of death, you know, where the body goes, what happens to it when it's put in the ground, that kind of thing. And I went to a Catholic school, so whenever I had questions about death, they were answered with religion, and it didn't really answer the practical questions I had. And as I grew up, I noticed that you don't really get any more answers as you grow up. Even if you ask them, if people try and tell you, they're kind of fudged or dodged. And when I grew up and became a journalist, I thought it would be a great a chance to kind of exploit my position, which is being able to go around and ask questions and go behind the scenes. And I wanted to meet the people who do know about the practicalities of death and do know what happens. And I just wanted to see what they did every day and how it affected them. So I've been thinking about it for many, many years. I'm 36 now, but I finished the book a couple of years ago. It took maybe 5 years to do, just in terms of finding people who would talk to me and then traveling to them. So the book, it goes across the UK and the US, and that isn't because I wanted to do a book that, you know, it was a big road trip across America. That's because it's hard to find people who will speak to you, to get to these people who trusted me enough to show me what, you know, what they do. It took levels and levels of character reference. So I ended up in places that I never expected to. And I met some amazing people. And it's all because they were generous enough to show me.
Yeah, and your book is interesting because you break it out by chapters, and each chapter talks about one of these people that you talk to and what their work entails and how they got into that industry. Can you share, one of the chapters talks about Poppy Martle, and Poppy went from working at an auction house to being a funeral director. Tell us her story and what you learned from her.
Well, Poppy, she did used to work in an auction house when she was in her 20s, and she found that that line of work was to her kind of meaningless, and she wanted to find a job that was somewhere on the scale of human importance, either involved in birth or marriage or death. She wanted to do one of the big ones. She wasn't sure which. And then both of her parents got cancer diagnoses in quick succession, and she had to look at funeral options while they were still alive. And she saw that something was missing in the funeral industry, that it was very stiff and conventional, and her family was quite artistic, and there was nothing there that really spoke to her. But she didn't really do anything with that until she herself got sick. She came down with typhoid and she nearly died. And it struck her that she was frightened for reasons that we don't need to be. She was confronting death without ever having seen a dead body. And she likened it, when I interviewed her, she said, it's sort of like if I was 9 months pregnant and I was about to give birth, but I'd never seen a baby before, that whole experience would be so much more frightening than it needs to be. And so she saw a chance to change the funeral industry in any way, in the small way that she can. So she started this independent funeral home, which is in South London. And I found her because she was giving a speech at a wake for a long dead philosopher, but it was basically a chance for progressive thinkers to get together and talk about the way we treat death in society. And she stood up and she said that the first dead body you see should not be someone you love. And that we should be given the chance to separate the shock of seeing death for the first time from the shock of grief. And what really stuck with me is that she said that she wished that she was able to bring children into her mortuary so that they could see death before they had to. And that's not something you hear every day. And so I had to go and talk to her. And she really gave me the opportunity of a lifetime, because until I did this book, I had never seen a dead body before. And I've had people who died. When I was 13, one of my best friends drowned. And I remember being at her funeral and the coffin was closed. And I don't remember anything that happened because I kept picturing her. And I'm sure all of the pictures in my head were much worse than the reality. So when I went to Poppy's, I just spent a day it was as if I was being trained to work there. And I helped dress a man for his coffin. And it was incredibly profound. And I didn't know this man. He was a stranger. And now I've completely changed my way of thinking about funerals. And my family know now that when anybody dies, I want to be there with them, because it's this final moment, this final thing you can do for them. It's sort of like doing the kids' shoelaces up at the school gates before they run off and away from you. And I think that there are so many moments around death that could be transformative for us and could be helpful. But because of the way we're taught in society that it's hidden and secret and we shouldn't know about it, I think we're missing out on all of them.
It's exactly, I think, what you're saying. You know, you're gaining new perspective from people who are seeing death in a different way. One of the areas that I thought was interesting for you to go into is because I don't know what happens here. It's when you donate your body to science. I know a lot of us think that that's a great thing to do, but I have no idea what would happen once I said yes. Can you go into what you found out?
Well, there are different ways of doing it. You can donate your body to a central brokering body department that sends bodies to where places need to be. But the one place I wanted to go was the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, because they have a very, it's a different way of doing it. You can will your body directly to the Mayo, and you don't have to live nearby. It's not a catchment area thing. So people will their bodies for many reasons. And some of those are because their lives were saved at that hospital, or the lives of someone they loved was saved there, and they want to give something back. And I met the man who has worked there for decades, who signs you up if you want to donate your body, and then receives you when you die. And he looks after you. And the thing that really stunned me was the fact that the way that they use the body for medical teaching is they don't wheel the whole body to different departments. They will separate the pieces so that they'll send the head to the dentistry department and orthopedics will get the hip. It's to make use of as much of the body as possible so nothing goes to waste. And something I found really touching was that each piece has a serial number on it, and nothing gets cremated until the entire body comes back and he can rebuild a human. So the body gets cremated in full and the family can get the ashes back. And there's a ceremony once a year where they, the teachers and the students do readings about, you know, the students have written poems about what the cadaver meant to them and what their thoughts were when they were working on it. You know, who was this person? Did they eat peanut butter from the jar kind of thing? And they read out all of the names, because when you're a medical cadaver, you are anonymous. Nobody knows your name, but it's somewhere in a system. So at the end, they do this massive funeral where all of the names are read out. I found it really, really emotional.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of the respect that the people working with cadavers have? And I'll share a little quick story for our audience. Here in Utah, high school students can take a class at the University of Utah, and you don't have to be like the superstar student to do this, and you can actually work with cadavers. And so my daughter did that, and the first day of class was all about respect for the cadavers. Can you talk a little bit more about when medical students are first introduced to cadavers, how that culture of respect is developed?
Well, there's the cliche that we think of medical students as being very crass and making jokes and throwing body parts around. And in the Mayo, Terry, the guy who looks after the cadavers, he says, first and foremost, we have to teach people to be respectful, and we need to get through to them the idea that this is a person who has gifted their body. He said, what is more personal a gift than their whole selves? And he says that when people, new students walk in, everybody reacts differently. Some people faint. Some people may be sitting down and then slide off the floor. He says they become a noodle because people are overwhelmed with, you know, seeing death for the first time. It can be overwhelming. But he said that, you know, they do various things to anonymize the person. So you won't recognize them. They'll shave the hair. After bodies have been embalmed in a medical sense, they can become quite bloated, so it can be hard to recognize who they were. So they become, you know, anonymous and you won't know them. But he keeps on various little details that are human, like tattoos will stay where they are. Or on the day I went, there was one cadaver there and she had her nails painted orange and gold. And he said that In the past, years ago, he used to remove the nail polish because he thought, you know, that we don't need that. This is decoration. We don't need it. I'll take it off. But then he heard a student talking about in that ceremony, talking about how the nail polish was what humanized this cadaver, and it got through to her that this was a person and this is a gift. And it's huge. So now he doesn't touch the nail polish. He leaves it on. And he says that he gets old men coming in, you know, medical cadavers who are old men. And he can tell that the nail polish has been put on by their grandchildren. Mm. And he says he leaves it all because it helps on an emotional level get through to the students that this is huge and you must be respectful.
I'm going to go a different route or down a different path with regards to the types of jobs that you investigated. One of those was a crime scene cleaner. So not necessarily someone who's dealing with a body directly necessarily. Who are these types of people who do this job and what does it really entail?
Well, the guy I spoke to is called Neil Smither, and I found him because he runs an Instagram account for his crime scene cleaner company, where he posts before and after pictures. And they're really gory. But I thought it was interesting that he was just posting them. And so I went to speak to him, and he got into it for a reason that I wouldn't have expected, because everybody else I've spoken to who works in the death industry do it out of some kind of, you know, calling, or they feel like they could make a difference. Whereas Neil, he was watching Pulp Fiction one day in the 90s when he was stoned, and he saw Harvey Keitel turn up to fix a murder scene that was done by John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson's characters. And while everybody else saw Pulp Fiction and thought, oh, I want to make movies, I want to write scripts, he thought, that is a business I could do. So he got into it for money. And you can tell that there's a different emotional approach to his job than to everybody else I spoke to, because the people I spoke to, these are not high paying jobs. Probably the person who earns the most is the crime scene cleaner. But he was the most affected by death, and he was the one who said he did fear death. And he, you know, he couldn't wait until he could leave, because all he was seeing by cleaning crime scenes every day, and he had been doing that job for something like 20 years at the time I spoke to him, he was just seeing the very worst of what humans are capable of. And he was completely sick of us. He couldn't wait to run away.
Yeah, no, that would be a tough job. Another really tough job that you explore in one of your chapters is a person that was an executioner and had taken the lives of 62 people in that profession. Tell us that story and kind of the key takeaways you learned from that discussion.
He was Virginia's state executioner for 17 years. But I found him because his name was at the bottom of a letter that was written to the governor of Arkansas, who was planning on doing a series of executions in a very short amount of time. And this letter was basically pleading with him to say, you know, this is putting undue stress on the staff on death row, and you can't do that. These people have to live with it. And everybody who signed it was like a warden or a chaplain, and Jerry was the only one who was there as the executioner. And historically, the executioner is anonymous. So I really wanted to go and speak to him and find out why he did his job for 17 years and why he was now against it. I think that's a really interesting flip to go from executioner to abolitionist. And I met him for dinner at Red Lobster. And he was a really sweet guy. And he had sort of put this story on his career retroactively, which was that God made him do it. And the way he spoke, he was sort of, it's like he couldn't quite face what he had done and needed to put the blame on somebody else, whether it was the justice system or God. It was somebody that wasn't him, because it was just too much for one person to handle. On the death team, he was the one who pressed the button, and he was the one who injected the lethal chemicals to kill the person. So it was a lot to take on. I really couldn't get a lot out of him, but I thought it was very, very telling that for the entire time he held that role, he didn't tell his wife, because he didn't want her to have to carry it too. And also on an execution day, he couldn't look at himself in the mirror because he didn't want to see himself as the executioner. So I think my biggest takeaway from having dinner with the executioner is all of the ways that we try and escape ourselves. And he seemed like a man who had some kind of trauma, but was trying to dodge it in his own mind. It felt, and he put up sort of fragile scaffolding to hold himself up. And I really didn't feel like it was my place to try and tear it down to see what he really thought about on the day of the execution. I just found it very sad. And I liked him. I didn't expect to meet an executioner and like him, but I did.
Fascinating insight into what you found with them. The other area that you explored was like a cryonics institute. What did you find there?
Well, I went to the cryonics institute because I thought it would be a nice end to a book where I was talking to people who confront death every day and who don't see any way we can avoid it. I thought it would be a good ending to speak to the people who think that they won't meet any of the people I just met, and that they can skip it and continue to live forever. And also, you know, cryonics has been painted as this crazy thing in Austin Powers and Futurama. And so I went expecting to find crazy people. But what I found was something much quieter. It's just, you know, it's not very futuristic looking. It's just a warehouse in quite a boring area north of Detroit. And the people there weren't trying, like, I felt like they'd be the kind of people who turn up on your doorstep and try and convert you. And they weren't. They were just saying, well, it might not work, but we know what happens when you put bodies in the ground or when you burn them. So we're in the experimental group. And all of this might fail, but it's worth a try anyway. And what I didn't expect to find was that people treat that warehouse like it's a graveyard. So they, family will come and visit these, they call them cryostats, where they hang the bodies. They're sort of like giant thermos things, and they're not transparent. You can't see what's going on. But people will come and visit them. And if they're Jewish, they will leave little stones underneath them. And I found it far more touching than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be funny, and it wasn't. It was the opposite.
Yeah, really interesting. And I think that's one of the themes in your book, is just how our preconceived notions are often very, very different than the reality of the situation. What are some commonalities that you found among those people that choose to work in the death industry?
Well, I thought that if I put them all together, if I pieced them all together, I might find some antidote to the fear of death. And I didn't. I found that people who work with the dead can be just as frightened as us, or there are some bits that they don't want to look at because they don't think they can handle it. And I also found that, you know, we talk about people being able to do hard jobs because they become desensitized to them. And I found the opposite. I found that, you know, they had a detachment, but I didn't see that it was a cool one. It was like they had separated themselves or stepped back just enough to allow themselves to be able to carry out the job without falling apart. But the one thing that was most shocking to me was that nobody sees all of death. They just see their one little patch. So it's quite, you know, nobody, you're not supposed to do what I did and try and see all of it, because too much of it can be overwhelming.
We appreciate the time that we've spent with you today, Haley Campbell. She is the author of All the Living and the Dead, From Embalmers to Executioners, An Exploration of People Who Have Made Death Their Life's Work. Haley, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thank you for having me.
In today's competitive job market, labor and talent shortages are among the challenges to finding and retaining the next member of your team. Now more than ever, employers must be creative and better connected to their community resources and partners to face these challenges. Wages are not the only way to demonstrate an investment in your team. Nicole Tilka, Assistant Director for the Workforce Development Division at Utah's Department of Workforce Services, is going to join us this morning to discuss their efforts and services as part of September's National Workforce Development Month. Thank you for joining us, Nicole.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So we talked, you know, everybody knows about the shortages and the difficulty of attracting team members to their companies. We go to restaurants and they're understaffed, or maybe they're not seating all the tables, or they have reduced hours. Everybody is feeling the pinch here. What statistics can you share with us about Utah's labor market, and what factors are leading to this tight labor market here?
Yeah, so right now Utah is experiencing really a historically low unemployment rate. We're at 2% unemployment rate right now. So when you just think about the unemployment rate in and of itself, that's kind of feeding into a lot of this competitive nature for employers to hire and retain some of their talent. So that's definitely playing a huge factor into some of these hiring challenges employers are facing. Additionally, just due to the pandemic, we saw a significant number of folks from the baby boomer generation that were retiring. Also a lot of opportunities for folks to kind of take a look at their career during that time. And just not as many young people coming in to fill those vacancies of those that were retiring and leaving the workforce. So those factors, additionally, right now we have around 3 job openings available for every 1 person that's looking for work in Utah. So when you look at all of that combined, kind of making some of those challenges employers are seeing in trying to hire and retain talent.
One of the ways that you suggest employers can build their workforce is through worksite learning programs. Can you give us some examples of these programs and assistance Workforce Services provides?
Yeah, definitely. So one of those ways is kind of training your workforce. So maybe thinking of folks that maybe don't have the skills right now, but with some training and some assistance, they could be a great candidate to fill those needs. So Department of Workforce Services, we offer a couple different opportunities, one of which is our on-the-job training program, where we offer employers reimbursements or incentives to hiring individuals that just need some training. So maybe they'd be a good candidate, but they just need some training. So what we'll do is we'll come in and kind of help offset some of the costs of training those individuals to be a great fit for that position. Additionally, we also have our employer internship opportunities, and this is kind of more for helping fill maybe some of those temporary work needs, starting off with someone that maybe doesn't have as much work experience and maybe needs some more coaching. So again, we'll come in, we'll help reimburse the employer some of the trainees' wages and really help that employer get the opportunity to train someone, help them get kind of the individual that they're looking for, training them how they like, even though they might not have the skills at the time. Through these worksite programs, we're kind of coming in trying to help offset some of the costs employers might face as they kind of try to train these new individuals.
And I know one of the powers here in Utah is our community colleges are extremely strong. And play a nice role in providing a lot of this training that people need for certain skill levels and really to skill up, to level up to the next area. Do you work much with the community colleges? And if so, what role does your group do?
Yeah, definitely. We are great partners with our community colleges throughout the state, technical colleges. Those are really great opportunities for folks to get some short-term training or kind of like you mentioned, upskill. So we work with those colleges throughout the state, kind of trying to say what we're seeing with employers, come together, see how we can help meet those employer needs. We do also have programs where we can assist in paying for training potentially for some of those individuals that might be going to the community college. So if someone comes into us, says, hey, I need to get some increased skills to make some better wages for them and their family, we'll help connect them to the community college or various schools throughout the state, and then we might be able to help assist in paying for that training as well.
What about the opposite side of that equation? So you're helping, as the name implies, you're helping to develop the workforce skill sets and availability here in Utah. But what about an employer that might be having troubles attracting the talent that they need and maybe need to get creative in where they do outreach, maybe a restaurant going down to Utah Valley University where they have a culinary school to hire some team members for their restaurants? Can you point local business owners to resources that they might want to think about to attract more people?
Yeah, definitely. So we'll really work with an employer when they connect with us and kind of see what they have been doing, try and connect them to other opportunities, whether that's trying to connect them to those local colleges, maybe try and connect to other opportunities. We're definitely not the experts in all things, but trying to connect where we can as possible. We do also offer virtual job fairs that are available for folks throughout the state, so a good opportunity. And any job fairs that we're aware of, we'll try and connect those employers to as many opportunities as can to help them meet their needs.
Another creative solution that you've suggested is to develop your workforce is to tap into hidden talent pools. One of those is the Refugee Services Office. Can you share more information about these communities and how to reach them?
Yeah, so at the Department of Workforce Services, we have our Refugee Services Office that works with both refugees as well as employers, helping connect the two. So for example, in the federal fiscal year 2022, we had around 1,500 refugees arrive in the state of Utah, which includes around 920 Afghan refugees and about 150 Ukrainian refugees. And a lot of these folks that are coming in are well educated and can really be a great asset to an employer and their workforce. So what our Refugee Services Office tries to do is they work with employers, educating them on how to engage with this population and think about them maybe a little differently than they have in the past, as well as we work with and assist those refugees, helping them get ready to be competitive for those employment opportunities, whether that's some additional training or just some job coaching, or just being a connecting point with these employers.
And another group that's underneath Workforce Services is the Utah Office of Rehabilitation. Tell us what type of rehabilitation that group works with and how they help connect employers with folks going through rehab.
Yeah, so specifically our State Office of Rehabilitation Services is working with individuals with a disability. So we, again, just like our Refugee Services Office and other divisions within our department, we're helping connect employers and those individuals that have that need. So our rehabilitation services will work with those with disabilities to help get them training, whether that might just be a certification, maybe it's helping get some licensure, going back to school, whatever that need might be. They're helping those individuals, and then they're also working with employers, kind of helping them understand what it's like when they're hiring someone with a disability, how to navigate that, and think about that a little differently, especially if that's a population that they haven't really thought about and worked with as well. So our Rehabilitation Services Office offers workshops for employers to kind of help educate and answer any questions that they have, as well as working with individuals with disabilities to help them get into training and be successful in a job.
There's also a veterans team that provides priority services for veterans, military members, and spouses. And not only is the veteran community a source for employees, but there's also tax credits available for employers who hire qualified veterans. Can you share more about more information about this?
Yeah. So we offer priority of service to veterans and their spouses and those military members. So this is one of the services we provide at Department of Workforce Services. Employers can engage with our veteran services team if they are wanting to capitalize on hiring this population and learn how they can better engage with them. And as you mentioned, there are tax credits available to hiring veterans that an employer could take advantage of. And so kind of all those services combined might be a great opportunity or resource for an employer that's looking to hire someone and maybe think about someone that they might not have thought of before.
And one of the challenges that some employers face is they have to provide bonding for their employees because of the nature of the job. Maybe they're going into people's homes, or there's liability potentially associated with that. And some potential employees are harder or more expensive to bond than others. And I understand the state of Utah helps out with that. How do you help, and how does an employer get your assistance?
Yeah, so we have the ability to assist with bonding individuals that might be harder to employ. Maybe those individuals that don't have a work history, if someone's got a background, an employer would like to have some of that security of bonding those individuals, kind of like you mentioned, just depending on what their job entails. What we can do is we can assist in bonding those individuals. And so we'll work with the employer, pretty easy process to get bonding set up for that individual for a certain amount of time while they're working through getting them hired and making sure they're a good fit on the job. Again, one of those services that we offer to employers to try and help them hire individuals that maybe they haven't thought of before. And one of the ways that we can help employers as they're trying to fill their needs.
You've done a great job of highlighting kind of all these areas where workforce development specialists across the state can help. Can you let our listeners know how they can find out more and find out more about these programs as well as receive assistance?
Yeah, definitely. So as you mentioned, we have workforce development specialists. They are individuals that specifically work with our employers. They're available across the state of Utah, regardless of where you're at. We can help you out. All you need to do is go to our website, jobs.utah.gov. /employers and take a look at the list of our workforce development specialists there. You can also go just onto our website at jobs.utah.gov, explore resources that are available to you there, expanding on kind of what I've mentioned today. We also have the ability for employers to post their jobs on our website, and we have over 180,000 active job seekers on our website, so a great resource for employers to try and tap into some individuals to fill their needs. We also have 30 employment centers throughout the state that if you want to go to meet someone in person, you're welcome to walk into any job centers and get some assistance in person as well.
Can I clarify a number you just stated? 180,000 job seekers are on your website?
Yes, throughout the state of Utah.
Yes, okay, that's good to know.
Yeah. Wow. 2% unemployment is crazy, crazy low unemployment. So congratulations to you and your team. You're obviously doing your job very, very well. But is there anything that's going on? At the same time unemployment is 2%, we have more people that are choosing not to go into the workforce. Maybe before COVID, they were close to retirement, they were older, and they said, you know what, I'm just done, I'm gonna retire early. Here in Park City, we have a lot of people that do part-time jobs at the ski resorts. It's fun, it's a way to socialize and meet other people. Does your group work with those folks that have chosen not to be in the workforce to maybe encourage them to consider working part-time, or do you engage with that community or no?
Yeah, so I mean, we engage across the board. It's kind of however folks find us, we're happy to help them explore different opportunities. So whether that's someone saying like, hey, maybe I think I want to get a part-time job just because I want to do something, even though I'm retired, we can help and work with those individuals to try and find opportunities that are going to meet their interests and needs. So we'll definitely work with anyone that comes and connects with us wherever they might be, as well as try and get the word out as much as possible about the services that we offer and help educate folks on maybe thinking about work differently than they have in the past.
Okay, well, as I said, 2% unemployment is crazy low. Congratulations to you and your team for being one of the forces that has caused that, but also working to make it easier for employers to find skilled people, including helping to skill up some of those people. We've been speaking with Nicole Tilka. Nicole, thank you very much for joining us. The Park City School District offers classes for all ages from pre-K through adults through the Compass, their leisure learning catalog. The Compass brochure arrives in our mailbox quarterly and contains classes from computer skills, culinary arts, fitness, languages, youth classes, leisure, and more. Jane Tolley, the Leisure Learning Coordinator with the Park City School District, joins us this morning to highlight the program and their offerings. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
So tell us, how long has the Park City School District been offering leisure learning, and why is it important to the school district to provide these types of classes to the community?
The program started in 1999, and I think it's important for members of the community who don't have kids in the school district to see the facilities and learn something new, and also to connect with each other and as, you know, community members and friends. A lot of good friendships have been made in Compass classes.
I've been a taker of these classes for many years, and I'm always excited to see what the offerings are. And many of us know the Compass because it arrives in our mailbox. I think if you're within the Park City School District limits, you receive one of these maybe quarterly. One of the things I saw this year is Dr. Nancy Taylor. She's an advocate for older adults, and she's providing a series of workshops. Can you give us an overview of those workshops and what they cover and the importance of adding these to this catalog this year?
Well, Dr. Nancy Taylor called me, and she said, I have these classes that I would like to do. And I was thinking, well, you know, we've done that before. But when she told me what they were, I understood the importance of what she has to share. She's an adult advocate, and she's a pharmacist. And so what she's saying is, like, you know, I'm old enough for Medicare, now what? And, you know, that's a crazy maze that, you know, the healthcare system overall is just daunting. And so she's going to talk about what type of Medicare is available, you know, what's a good idea, what's a bad idea, important dates to get ready for that, some pitfalls to watch out for. And she's also talking about polypharmacy, what is too many medications. And, you know, a lot of my friends who have older parents, you know, they're on all these medications and they don't need them all. So she's going to help navigate that too. And then some estate planning, and also what her role as an older adult advocate is.
So talk to us, what are some of the more popular programs? We mentioned in the intro language learning and computer science, and I kind of view myself as a lifelong learner, so I love doing that kind of stuff, mostly online just because my life has been busier. But what are the more popular courses that there's a lot of demand for every quarter?
Language classes for sure, and fitness classes. So we have yoga with Randy Joe, and she teaches an adult class. It's on Tuesdays. We need one more person to sign up for that. We have Pilates with Essence Pilates, and that's ran by Danny Lofuedo. And the interesting story about Danny is she had a career. She came to the Compass. She took Pilates and then found out that that's where her passion is. So she quit her job and opened a Pilates studio during a pandemic. And it's successful. She has a lot of private clients and a lot of group classes through the Compass. So during the pandemic, when she opened her studios, we were able to adapt, you know, and do a lot of like online classes and private classes. And it worked for her. I'm like, if she can do that, she can do anything. She's amazing.
I agree. A lot of the classes that are put within the compass really, in my mind, fall into, you know, either self-development. So as you mentioned, like language classes. I know that Sue-Ann Kern, she has a professional speaking class that people have. But then there's also like art classes. There's storytelling with Stacey Domalski and writing books. Quite a bit of things to kind of get us out of our normal workday brain.
Yes, all of that. So a lot of people, you know, you're thinking, I shouldn't write a book, you know, or I should turn my story into a book. And she can help guide you through that. Like Stacey is a professional, and she's a published author, and she's a member of the Writers Guild of America. So our teachers are experts in their field, and they're passionate about it. And I think that is what makes these Compass classes a success, is because they're so passionate about what they're doing and they want to share it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Park City is a unique town in that we have highly accomplished people that have chosen to move here. So we have these people with these amazing skill sets. So I'm sure you have a lot of people say, hey, I'd like to do a class on this, a class for that. And you have to balance it out, right? Is there demand for that? Is that a quote-unquote public good, a class like that? How do you choose what outside of the core, like we were talking earlier, fitness, computer science, and language, how do you choose sometimes these smaller topics, which ones that you think will resonate with the community and is a match for the Compass, and which ones maybe should be done privately and not through the Compass? How do you choose that?
Well, a lot of thought goes into that, and I actually get a call every day from, or an email from, people wanting to put a class in the Compass. And part of the thought process of that is, where are we at as a community and a nation? You know, would this class, will it fill a need, and will it be successful? Because the way that the Compass runs is the price of the class has to pay for the printing and mailing of the Compass, the teacher payroll, the supplies, the taxes, the insurance, all of that. So to be in here, it has to be a success, you know. And I don't like to cancel classes, but I do on occasion have to cancel them for low enrollment. And that way, it's a self-funded program that we can keep going here. So,
as we get close to wrapping up, one of the things I wanted to highlight was that there's online career training programs as well as instructor-led online short courses. And some of the topics I had seen, you know, is like QuickBooks, you know, or computer applications and things like that. How do those programs become available through the Compass?
Well, I sought them out. So it's because, you know, a lot of people need QuickBooks, but there's so many different versions of that. And then, you know, during during COVID, there was a lot of people who were switching careers. So I'm like, well, let's help them. So we did the online career training. Recently, they just had a new class that they've added, a CDL. You can get your CDL license through them. And, you know, so...
Commercial driver's license?
Yes, yeah. Yes. So
that opens a lot of doors for people.
Yeah, and, you know, so get your CDL and come be a bus driver for the school district.
Oh, feed your own.
Let me. We need to wrap, but the last question I have is, you know, the classes I think are very affordable, but for some people it is a financial burden to pay that tuition. Do you offer scholarships or financial aid, and how do people inquire about that?
The career training does offer scholarships and financial aid, but I do not, unfortunately, have any scholarship money for Compass classes.
Okay, well, maybe sometime in the future. We've been speaking with Jane Tolley. She is the Leisure Learning Coordinator with Park City School Districts. Jane, thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to Mountain Money. Please leave a review on your podcast app. It would be helpful for us.